This episode features discussion of kidnapping, suicidal ideation, violence, and murder that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. August 1968. After 10 brutal months in captivity, 32-year-old Lieutenant John Sidney McCain gave up hope of returning home to the United States. He decided death was better than an eternity of torture and imprisonment.
He wound a curtain cord around his neck while standing on a small chair, took one last deep breath. Then, with a whispered goodbye to the world, he kicked the chair away.
Rapidly losing consciousness, he could just barely recognize the shadowy forms crowding into his cell. His North Vietnamese captors, the same men who broke his bones and teeth, rushed in to cut him down and save his life.
This was not an act of kindness. Because of his father's position as commander of the Pacific Forces, John McCain was a high-value prisoner. He offered leverage over the American military. His captors called him the Crown Prince.
McCain was simply too valuable to be allowed to die. Alive, he could be used as a bargaining chip.
So John McCain continued to suffer brutal beatings, torture, interrogations, and solitary confinement. It was a bleak, miserable existence where even death was too much to hope for.
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our second episode on the captivity of John McCain and his long road back to freedom. Last week, we covered McCain's plane crash in North Vietnam and his brutal first months as a prisoner of war.
In today's episode, we'll examine how McCain fought back from the depths of despair, bonded with fellow POWs, manipulated his captors, and survived 5.5 years until his final release.
By the fall of 1968, John McCain had spent almost a year in captivity. During that time, he had been brutally beaten, tortured, and kept in near constant isolation. His captors wanted him to go on record confessing to war crimes and had been relentless in attempting to extract that confession through force.
McCain fell into a deep depression. He lost any hope of going home and even attempted to take his own life. But the North Vietnamese would not afford him such kindness. His beatings continued with renewed vigor.
Finally, desperate to end his near-constant suffering, McCain relented. He agreed to give a false confession. It was quick, but direct. He stated, quote, "I am a black criminal, and I have performed the deeds of an air pirate. I almost died, and the Vietnamese people saved my life," end quote.
As his confession was broadcast over Radio Hanoi, McCain fell into a near catatonic depression. He knew his fellow soldiers and his father would hear the coerced statement that he had betrayed his values, his family, and his country.
McCain later said, "I had learned what we all learned over there. Every man has a breaking point. I had reached mine."
John McCain had hit rock bottom. But as the saying goes, when you have nothing left to lose, the only way to go is up. One night, as he lay on his cell floor, he was struck with a moment of clarity. He realized that although he couldn't change his circumstances, he could change his own behavior. there had to be a way to make solitary confinement tolerable.
Well, by this time, John McCain had been in solitary confinement for nearly 6 months. His torturers were sure he would break down and beg for leniency if he was deprived of social interaction long enough.
McCain knew that giving the North Vietnamese what they wanted would damage the morale of his fellow POWs. He refused to break again.
But John was starved for human contact. He had to reach out to other POWs if he wanted to survive. And thanks to tips from POWs he'd interacted with previously, he knew how he might be able to do it. In a tiny cell next door to John McCain was Air Force Captain and fellow POW John Furr.
Captain Furr had also been shot down in Vietnam in 1967.
One night in February 1968, Furr heard a faint but insistent tapping on an adjacent wall inside the prison.
Furr recognized that sound for what it was, military code, specifically tap code, an elaborate system of tapping out the alphabet to convey messages.
Well, military code tapping is markedly different from Morse code. It's not dashes and dots, but a series of taps, each one representing a letter.
If a listener understands the tap, he taps back 2 times. If he or she does not, he taps back a series of rapid signals, indicating they don't understand and to repeat.
The rhythmic sounds that reached Furr in his cell slowly spelled out in tap code the familiar phrase, shave and a haircut. Furr excitedly tapped back, 2 bits.
When he heard Furr's reply, John McCain knew that he had found an ally. No prison guard or enemy soldier would have both understood the code and produced the correct reply so quickly.
Furr and McCain continued to talk through tap code. First, they shared their names and ranks. Then they went on to more personal details. Over the next few days, the two men became close friends.
Prison rules strictly prohibited contact between POWs who were assigned to solitary confinement. By communicating with each other, both McCain and Furr were risking torture, but they didn't care. Their need for human contact was more important.
A POW researcher, Lieutenant Colonel Bobby D. Wagnon, describes communication as the essential antecedent to a 3-pronged approach for POW survival. He said during the Vietnam War specifically, secret communication between POWs made the captive soldiers far better equipped for survival than their Korean War counterparts.
According to Wagnon, once communication between POWs has been established, 3 critical social phenomena occur. First, social interaction. Second, group dynamics between POWs. And third, the integration of new POWs into the group.
Wagnon writes, quote, communication with other POWs allows a means to join a new society and develop a new familiar.
McCain himself said communication with fellow POWs was key to his survival. He later reflected on the benefits of this communication, saying, quote, it was valuable to establish a chain of command in our camps so senior officers could give us advice, end quote.
Wagnon also notes that communication between POWs benefits them by establishing discipline, routines, and responsibilities. Senior officers may give lower-ranking POWs simple tasks they can accomplish while imprisoned, such as passing a message to their neighbors through tap code. Assigned tasks give POWs a sense of purpose and a reason to continue fighting to survive.
McCain himself said, quote, the most important thing for survival is communication with someone, even if it's only a wave or a wink, a tap on the wall, or to have a guy put his thumb up. It makes all the difference, end quote.
After successfully making contact, in October of 1968, McCain began to share his love of classic literature with Furr.
McCain taught Furr one of his favorite poems, If, by Rudyard Kipling, by painstakingly tapping out the letters to each word in the poem. McCain likewise tapped out long passages he'd memorized from books by his favorite authors, Ernest Hemingway and John Steinbeck.
Discussing literature through tap code took hours, but the POWs didn't mind. Long conversations meant more time spent with a sense of purpose and less time alone with their own dark thoughts.
Eventually, the North Vietnamese guards realized that solitary confinement was not breaking McCain the way they had hoped.
The guards removed both Fur and McCain from solitary confinement and placed them in a shared cell. The two POWs jokingly called their shared accommodation the big room, although the cramped cell was nothing of the sort.
While living together, the close friends found creative ways to pass the time. They played chess with homemade chess pieces and paper chessboards. When a sympathetic guard gave them a deck of playing cards, both men were delighted.
McCain had always been an avid bridge player and soon taught Fur to play.
In the winter of 1968, McCain and Fur were allowed to play bridge against other POWs, and the pair quickly became the prison's bridge champs. Other prisoners said they played so well together, it was like they could read each other's minds.
Indeed, McCain and Fur had grown inseparable. They knew everything about one another's lives. They were brothers.
Their friendship was all thanks to those first few taps on a clammy cell wall.
But the tap code wasn't just good for building social bonds and creating a sense of normalcy in the prison. It also helped the POWs exchange strategic information and gain the upper hand against their captors.
Orson Swindle was a charismatic Marine fighter pilot who had been shot down 2 years earlier in November 1966 during his final scheduled flight over North Vietnam. In 1968, he was moved to the cell that shared a wall with John McCain and John Furze.
Swindle began to chat with McCain through tap code, but his conversations with McCain were less personal than Furze. Swindle was mostly interested in using tap code to outsmart his captors.
Swindle and McCain listened one night as another POW arrived back in a cell after an interrogation. McCain reached out with his shave and a haircut query.
The POW communicated back, two bits in code, by banging on his metal cup. McCain and Swindle listened as the unknown POW described his interrogation. He relayed what the North Vietnamese soldiers did to him, how he was beaten, and what questions they asked.
McCain and Swindle spread this information around the camp via tapping, one cell at a time. The other POWs responded by reporting back on their own interrogation experiences. This allowed POWs to anticipate how they might be tortured next and mentally prepare to withstand it.
Well, this practice gave the prisoners a sense of power. By sharing secrets with each other, they were able to take back a measure of control over their lives.
Interrogations at the Hanoi Hilton were still horrifying. A favorite technique, called the rope trick, involved binding a prisoner's arms behind his body, then rotating his arms upward until his shoulders became dislocated.
John McCain was subjected to this form of torture repeatedly. Between the rope trick and his ill-fitting arm casts from when he was first interred, he would never be able to raise his arms above his shoulders again.
Decades later, when McCain would run for president in 2008, reporters would often cite this impediment as the reason for his signature wave at rallies, straight out in front of his body instead of overhead, like most politicians.
Well, clearly, this torture was brutal, but at least with their secret lines of communication open, the men knew what to expect. One fellow POW, James Stockdale, consoled the camp with the phrase, quote, "Men are disturbed not by things, but by the view that they take of them."
The POWs trusted each other completely. Swindle noted, quote, "We had to be truthful with one another because we had nothing else to rely on other than ourselves."
Trust and loyalty were also key to the friendship between McCain and another POW, Ernie Brace.
When Brace entered the prison in October 1968, he was terrified. He had been a POW since 1965, but not in a prison like the Hua Lo. Instead, he had suffered over 2 years of being tortured, beaten, and starved in the jungle. He was once buried up to his neck for a week as punishment for attempting to escape.
So when he was suddenly thrust into a prison cell at Hua Lo, Brace didn't know what to expect. He was slow to trust and constantly on edge.
Like he had with Fur and then with Swindle, McCain reached out through tap code when he heard Brace enter a nearby cell. Brace quickly recognized the tapping as coded letters of the English alphabet, but he was too scared to reply.
McCain tapped again, then listened. The silence was deafening. McCain and Fur supposed that the new prisoner either didn't know tap code or wasn't willing to talk. Then, after a long while, they heard a faint tapping sound.
Brace finally tapped back, but only gave his name.
McCain tapped again, giving his name, his year of capture, his military branch affiliation, and basic information. But once again, Brace tapped just his name.
McCain could hear Brace sobbing. He tapped again, this time sharing words of comfort and consolation. Brace began to open up.
Slowly, McCain learned from Brace that he was a civilian contractor working for the CIA. He used to fly for the Marines, but was dishonorably discharged. Brace had been flying for the CIA as an independent pilot when he was shot down.
Over the next several weeks, Brace and McCain shared intensely personal thoughts. Both men came to count on their nightly conversations to keep their morale up.
McCain taught Brace to put his tin cup up to the wall and to speak softly through it. This allowed the two men to hear each other's voices at night when the prison was quiet. Slowly, McCain got Brace to open up.
McCain soon learned that Brace had not spoken to another American in 3 years. He had been in solitary confinement, like McCain, but in conditions even worse than those in the Hanoi Hilton.
The two men talked every night, sharing their thoughts and life stories. McCain noted later, quote, "I vividly remember our conversations and how we kept each other's spirits up during those dark days. Our hope never wavered."
McCain and Brace also bonded over their refusal to ask for early release. Both believed it was a violation of the military code of conduct for POWs to be released in any order other than the order in which they were captured.
The men grew to depend on each other's company. Sadly, that fact didn't escape their captors.
One night, the North Vietnamese removed McCain and Brace from their cells. To prevent the men from seeing each other, the North Vietnamese blindfolded both.
Brace was moved to another part of the camp. McCain and Brace never saw each other again during their time as prisoners.
McCain noted later, quote, "I'll never forget the tapping to each other and the leadership and inspiration that I got from those people who were far better and stronger than I."
The two men never met face to face during the entire length of their captivity, but the friendship was real and lasting. It brought McCain strength.
But that newfound strength was soon tested. A brutal new commander, known as Colonel Tran Trong Duyet, arrived at the Hanoi Hilton, hell-bent on breaking John McCain's spirit, no matter what it took.
In a moment, the new colonel takes a special interest in John McCain. Now back to the story.
In June of 1969, after 18 months in captivity, 32-year-old Lieutenant John McCain was finally starting to find stability in his life as a prisoner of war. Despite near-constant torture and horrific conditions, he had made friends among the other POWs.
The POWs had used a secret tap code to share information throughout the prison. U.S. commanding officers were able to use the tap code to give orders to their fellow soldiers. The prisoners were now functioning less like inmates and more like comrades working together on a single mission.
That is, until North Vietnamese Colonel Tran Trong Duyet arrived.
Duyet was placed in charge of Hoa Lo Prison, aka the Hanoi Hilton. He wanted to make his mark right away by breaking the spirit of the prison's most valuable hostage.
Duyet noticed that McCain was mentally tougher and stronger than the others. He knew that McCain was the son of the commander of the Pacific Forces and inferred that the younger McCain must have been raised to be a soldier.
Duyet was likewise stronger and more clever than his peers. Secretly, he identified with McCain. He sought him out, pushing him, challenging him.
Duyette grew to like McCain, but just like the American POWs, Duyette was loyal to his own country. He was placed in command at Hua Lo to lay down the law and extract valuable intelligence from the prisoners, not to befriend them.
So Duyette made an example of McCain. He threatened him with constant punishment. He isolated McCain and forced him to endure long interrogations, hoping to get another confession out of him.
When threats didn't work, Duyette tried another tactic. He allowed McCain certain special benefits, like increased time out of his cell. He tried to make McCain think they were friends, hoping the American soldier would open up to him.
McCain didn't budge. He would not confess to crimes he hadn't committed. He would not provide his enemies with intelligence on American forces.
On one occasion, after a particularly grueling interrogation, McCain sat across from Duyette in his office, and Duyette gave McCain an alternative perspective. He explained that here in Vietnam, Duyette was the war hero, not McCain. He showed McCain a chest of military medals awarded to Duyette's unit for bravery.
Duyette went on to tell McCain that the nurse, Wen T. Tyne, who treated McCain after his plane crash, had lost loved ones in the war. She had even debated over whether or not to kill the young American pilot. When she decided to treat him instead, she was scorned by her village for it.
McCain knew that Duyette was trying to garner empathy in the hopes McCain might give him information. McCain still refused to give Duyette information, but his empathy was fully earned.
After that conversation, the two men shared an understanding.
Not long after, John McCain caught the flu and became ill enough to be briefly taken to the prison's makeshift hospital ward. Duyette slept on a cot next to him. He was concerned that nurses less conscientious than Nurse Tyne might kill McCain overnight.
Duyette learned that McCain loved to read, so he gave McCain books and periodicals. All of the materials were propaganda in support of Vietnamese revolutionary leader Ho Chi Minh.
Duyette expected McCain would refuse to read the propaganda. Instead, McCain not only read the material, he recited it back from memory. As we mentioned with the poems earlier, recitation was a talent of his, honed in boyhood by memorizing passages of his favorite books.
Duyette was fascinated by McCain's intelligence and mental fortitude, and invited McCain to sit in his office and talk for hours about family, travel, and even women.
One afternoon, the two men were chatting casually in Duyette's office. Duyette asked John McCain, "What are you going to do when you get home?"
McCain had never thought much about that subject. Surviving his imprisonment was his first priority, but now that the question was posed, he realized he did not want to go back to flying bombing missions for the U.S. Air Force, at least not for very long, certainly not past the end of the Vietnam War.
As Duyette drummed his fingers on his desk and waited for an answer, an idea came to McCain. There was a job he could do that would make use of his experiences as a soldier and as a leader among his fellow prisoners.
John McCain calmly answered, "I'll become a politician."
Eventually, McCain convinced Duyette to let him out of his cell to roam the prison yard, where he could interact with other American POWs. This was the first time in over a year of captivity that John McCain had had regular face-to-face contact with other American soldiers outside of sporadic and heavily watched bridge tournaments.
American POWs had nicknamed the prison yard Las Vegas. They also named different sections of the prison after Las Vegas Strip casinos. This reminded McCain and other POWs of home. It also helped them keep track of where their fellow POWs were housed.
Asking another favor of Commander Duyette, McCain got himself transferred to the Gold Nugget. There he interacted with other POWs living in the Thunderbird, the Desert Inn, the Stardust, and the Riviera.
His daily stints in the prison yard were like balm to McCain's emotional wounds. He was finally able to put faces to the names of men he had been communicating with for months. He was able to expand his network of allies.
McCain continued to cultivate his status as Duyette's favorite. At Duyette's request, McCain began to teach him how to improve his English.
Duyette constantly sought out time with McCain to practice. He told others McCain was an excellent teacher.
McCain's approach to befriending and subsequently manipulating Duyette aligns perfectly with the strategies employed by former FBI hostage negotiator Chris Voss.
Voss describes the difference between empathy and rapport and how each is essential to a hostage's survival. Empathy, which Voss recommends hostages employ, requires the hostage to understand their captor's perspective and identify with the captor's emotions.
Rapport takes the same tactics one step further. When a true rapport is established, the captor actually feels understood on a deeper level by their prisoner. A genuine mutual bond is created between hostage and hostage taker.
Well, this is precisely what McCain developed with Duyette. By teaching Duyette English and sharing personal conversations with him, McCain established rapport.
But underneath their pleasantries, McCain remained aware that Duyette was his enemy.
McCain used their rapport to lull Duyette into a false sense of security. Once the commander believed John McCain was his friend, he spent less time surveilling him and gave him more special privileges.
With Duyette distracted, McCain and other POWs stepped up their communication. The men exchanged daily secret hand signals, tap codes, and even written notes hidden in washroom drains.
Well, the entire camp buzzed with information, fed through underground channels run by the POWs. McCain and other POWs exchanged news from home and discussed new POWs brought into the camp. If any of them were released, they wanted to be able to share detailed information on their fellow inmates with the government and with prisoners' families at home in the United States.
McCain recited the POWs' names from memory nightly, reaching up to 80 unique names of American POWs held in his general vicinity. This comprised 1/4 of the total population in the camp at the time.
McCain had used psychological tactics and his knowledge of U.S. military procedures to essentially put himself in charge of his own prison. By keeping Duyette pacified, he enjoyed special privileges, which in turn allowed him to make the other men's lives a little easier.
But the peace between Duyette and McCain couldn't last long. They were ultimately on opposite sides of the conflict, and McCain would never choose protecting his friendship with Duyette over defending his fellow Americans. And soon, McCain would show his true colors on national television.
Christmas Eve, 1968. 50 POWs, including McCain, were herded into a room decorated with flowers for a Christmas service. The North Vietnamese planned to milk this moment for PR value. They had cameramen in place to film their supposed act of compassion in allowing the Americans to celebrate their holiday.
McCain was horrified at the thought that this video might actually convince Americans that the North Vietnamese were kind to their hostages. He'd been brutally beaten and tortured in the prison, his bones broken, and his mental fortitude exhausted.
McCain looked around the room for an opportunity. He spotted a POW who had just been transferred to the Hanoi Hilton. McCain charged over as cameras rolled and began telling the new POW the truth about the prison.
A guard, smiling for the cameras, told McCain to stop talking. McCain stated that his ranking superior was Colonel Larson, not the guard. Therefore, he would not be following the guard's orders. McCain kept talking.
As the guard continued to shout, "No talking," McCain cursed him out and flipped him off in full view of the cameras. He refused to back down, daring the guards to challenge Duyette's favorite. It was a risky move, publicly outing Duyette for his favoritism towards a prisoner.
The guards quickly concluded the Christmas service and led the men back to their cells. McCain expected to be dragged back out at any moment and taken to an interrogation room for a beating. The guards stayed away, but Christmas Day had never felt longer.
The beating eventually came the day after Christmas, but McCain noted how long it had taken for them to drag him out of his cell. They had never waited so long to punish a major transgression.
Something had happened. He just needed to figure out what had changed.
In a moment, McCain finally escapes the Hanoi Hilton. Now back to the story.
By Christmas of 1968, John McCain had been in the Hanoi Hilton prison for more than 14 months. Several of those months were spent in solitary confinement. He'd withstood torture, starvation, and mental abuse. But now, it felt like things were changing for the prisoners.
As 1968 drew to a close, back home in America, political winds were shifting. Prior to 1968, during the Johnson administration, POWs were forbidden to talk about conditions of their captivity upon their release. U.S. leaders believed that by speaking out, released POWs would make conditions worse for those left behind in Vietnam.
But by early 1969, the newly inaugurated President Nixon had a big problem on his hands. The American public was increasingly opposed to the Vietnam War.
Young war correspondents like Dan Rather showed stark scenes from the war in Vietnam on the nightly news. For the first time, American civilians saw the true brutality of war. They came to empathize with the North Vietnamese, especially the women and children who were killed in the conflict.
Families watched, worried, sick, as their loved ones were drafted and shipped out to the dangerous killing fields they saw on the news. Some Americans were so opposed to the military draft that they left the country for Canada.
Celebrities, including Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, and others, began to openly speak out against the war. Students protested on college campuses, burning American flags and demanding that the U.S. bring its troops home.
President Nixon wanted Americans to see the North Vietnamese as dangerous communist enemies, not as poor people being murdered by American imperialists. So he came up with a new plan. Nixon called upon the North Vietnamese to release sick and injured U.S. POWs.
Nixon believed that if Americans knew how poorly POWs were treated in Vietnam, they would be less sympathetic towards the North Vietnamese.
In a reversal of the Johnson administration's policies, Nixon encouraged U.S. POWs to describe in detail the horrors they had endured in captivity.
POWs now returned home and held full press conferences, detailing the horrifying conditions of their torture and mistreatment.
Although Nixon was unable to halt the progress of anti-war protests, these POW press conferences did reduce Americans' sympathy for the North Vietnamese. The propaganda released by North Vietnam was far less convincing, with American POWs standing at the ready to challenge it.
Back at the prison camp, despite injuries sustained through torture, McCain continued to refuse early release. Conditions at the prison were less brutal than before, with torture now a rarity. McCain and the other POWs sensed that something was changing.
By the fall of 1969, McCain's cell door was left open at night to let cool air in. McCain and other POWs were even allowed to bathe more often.
In December 1969, the North Vietnamese invited Cuban journalists to interview the POWs. McCain refused to speak with the communist reporters. He would only say that he did not regret any of his actions in the war.
As usual, McCain expected a beating. For the next several hours, he braced himself for what was to come. But nothing happened. McCain was, for the first time, allowed to resist direct orders from his guards without any consequences.
Well, McCain tested the boundaries of this new social order. He refused all visitors, including guards and interrogators. Again, he was left alone. No beatings, no punishments.
McCain and the other POWs, emboldened by this test, decided to push further. They all refused to participate when the North Vietnamese set up a propaganda photo shoot with foreign journalists.
Surprisingly, the North Vietnamese didn't even challenge them. This strange new normal continued for months, with the prisoners essentially free to behave however they pleased.
In December of 1970, McCain was moved to a large room with 40 to 50 other POWs. The POWs nicknamed their new cell block the Hotel Riviera. Their large communal area was Camp Unity. They couldn't believe they were now allowed to openly interact, chat, and trade information.
McCain and the other POWs bonded, strategized, and shared meals. They still didn't know why the North Vietnamese had suddenly become so lax about security.
By February 1971, McCain and other POWs felt so emboldened, they decided to stage a full-scale protest within the camp.
In March of 1971, McCain and the other POWs celebrated a church service. Religious observations were generally prohibited in the camp, and this was the first time since their capture that the POWs worshipped in a service not staged for a propaganda video.
When the guards recognized what was happening, the camp went into lockdown. Guards seized McCain and the other leaders of the service, but the remaining POWs were undeterred.
The men loudly began singing the Star Spangled Banner. Singing the national anthem was risky, but the POWs realized that for some reason, the North Vietnamese were now afraid to harm them.
McCain was taken to a punishment wing of the camp, nicknamed Skid Row. Conditions there were horrible, but far better than the solitary confinement cell where McCain had lived for several months.
Among the first people McCain met on Skid Row was an old friend, Marine Lieutenant Orson Swindle. It was their first face-to-face meeting, but they knew each other well.
Swindle and McCain had talked often through tap code when both were in solitary confinement. They shared their life stories and strategized against their guards together. Now they shared a cell.
Swindle and McCain again worked together, this time to keep each other strong and safe. They slept side by side, each looking out for the other. They even started a workout routine together. Both were determined to stay in fighting shape.
Due to his previous injuries, McCain couldn't bend his arms. Through trial and error, he found a way to do push-ups with straight arms. He also couldn't bend one of his legs because of his injuries. He insisted on jogging with Swindle anyway, although he often fell behind.
Swindle laughed at his friend's tilted push-ups and slow, wobbly running. This irritated McCain, but the two men bickered like siblings, not like enemies.
Swindle later said, quote, "We had our differences. On many occasions, we'd fight, argue, then 10 minutes later, be laughing about it. I loved him like a brother."
Well, these relationships helped McCain keep his sanity, which he would need as the years dragged on. By January of 1972, Lieutenant John McCain, now 35 years old, had been a prisoner of war for almost 5 years.
Back in the U.S., following the deaths of four young college protesters at Kent State, sentiment had turned sharply against the Vietnam War.
President Nixon decided to step up U.S. military bombings in hopes of ending the war quickly. He knew that the American public wouldn't tolerate the war dragging on for much longer. Nixon hoped that an escalation of hostilities would force the North Vietnamese to surrender, so on December 18, 1972, the so-called Christmas bombing raids began.
The order that began the bombing of Hanoi was given by Admiral Jack McCain. The elder McCain knew full well that the bombing might kill his son, who was imprisoned at the Hoa Lo prison camp in Hanoi. He gave the order anyway.
John McCain had a front row seat to his father's aggressive campaign. McCain witnessed bombs exploding on nearby buildings, sending Hoa Lo prison walls shaking. Surface-to-air missiles lit up the night sky and set off wailing sirens.
McCain and the other POWs realized that the sudden intense bombing was a sign. The U.S. wanted the war to end. The POWs wondered what would happen to the prisoners if Hanoi fell under American control. They might be released, or they might be killed at the last minute before the guards abandoned ship.
Everything at camp was outwardly the same. McCain and his fellow POWs knew they couldn't do anything about the bombings, so to keep their spirits up, they agreed to keep their routines unchanged. They held Sunday night movie reenactments, played bridge, and traded secret messages.
Outwardly, at least, the men maintained the new normal they'd created for each other in prison. But emotions ran high. The men were afraid. Sometimes they took it out on each other, even the usually even-keeled McCain.
One night, while McCain was playing bridge with Orson Swindle and two other POWs, he got into an argument with Swindle.
McCain had blown a perfect hand of cards. The other players teased him mercilessly. McCain became so offended, he stopped speaking to Swindle.
Swindle, who slept on the floor right next to McCain, assumed it would end. They were friends. But McCain stayed silent for days on end.
Then one night, several guards suddenly entered their shared cell. The guards abruptly told Swindle to pack his things. They said he was headed home.
As one of the first pilots taken prisoner, Swindle was, in fact, next in line to leave. But McCain panicked. He realized he might never see his friend again.
McCain ran up to Swindle and said, quote, "Orson, I've really been a jerk the last few days."
Swindle winked and said, "See you at home."
The words felt foreign. McCain realized it was the first time in years that he realistically thought he could go home someday.
Someday soon, in fact. John McCain had no way of knowing that the political landscape of the U.S. was changing and paving the way for his return.
Back home, massive anti-Vietnam War protests filled the streets, just as the Watergate investigation went underway.
Desperate to distract from the Watergate scandal, Nixon signed a peace treaty agreement on January 27, 1973, to end the Vietnam War.
The agreement between the United States, South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, and North Vietnam called for an immediate ceasefire. It also ordered the withdrawal of all U.S. troops and advisors from Vietnam and the dismantling of all U.S. bases within 60 days.
Most importantly for McCain, the North Vietnamese agreed to immediately release all prisoners of war.
March 14, 1973, exactly 2 months after the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, was a day John McCain would never forget. He was awakened in his cell. He and his fellow POWs were loaded onto trucks. They looked around in disbelief. Was this the last they'd see of the Hanoi Hilton?
By this point, 37-year-old John McCain was emaciated. His hair had turned prematurely white from stress. He hadn't been outside the prison in over 5 years. Everything seemed surreal.
McCain and the other POWs were driven to Gia Lam Airport in Hanoi. North Vietnamese citizens and soldiers lined the streets, staring at the Americans.
At the airport, McCain flagged down and spoke with a U.S. serviceman in uniform. The serviceman confirmed it. They were all going home.
McCain then recognized the Rabbit, one of his first North Vietnamese guards. The Rabbit told the men to listen for their names. When each man heard his name, he was to board a plane idling on the tarmac. The Rabbit began reading.
McCain heard his name called. He slowly boarded the plane, his hands shaking. The plane took off, and McCain finally let himself believe he was going home.
And sure enough, he was. But it wasn't easy.
John McCain was deeply traumatized by his time as a POW. In the years following his release, he experienced a bitter divorce and struggled with excessive drinking.
But McCain's perseverance, formed in the darkness of the Hanoi Hilton, ultimately led him to a successful congressional campaign, a legendary Senate career, and two presidential bids as a Republican candidate. He also returned to visit Vietnam more than 20 times over the course of his life. On August 25th, 2018, John McCain lost his battle with aggressive brain cancer.
Moments after news of John McCain's passing hit the airwaves, a reporter reached out to a controversial figure from McCain's past, Colonel Duyette, the former commander of Hoa Lo Prison.
Duyette had never forgotten his English teacher. He was distraught to hear of McCain's death. The retired colonel said, quote, "I feel very, very sad. Out of working hours, we considered each other friends."
It seems a fitting tribute that even John McCain's captor would admire his courage. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week with a new episode.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Paul Liebeskind, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Dorothy Kozak-Snoke and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.